It is my great pleasure to welcome our two speakers. To my immediate left is Professor Adunbi, who is an assistant professor in the Department of African American and African Studies at the University of Michigan. He is trained as an anthropologist, having received his PhD from Yale University. At Michigan, he is also a faculty associate in the program in the environment. He also has attained his certificates in human rights education and enforcement from institutions in London, Copenhagen, The Hague, and Harare. His research has focused on resource distribution, governance, human and environmental rights, power, culture, multinational corporations, and the post-colonial state, of course, mostly in Nigeria. He's currently working on a book manuscript titled Belonging to the Soil, with the S in parentheses, NGOs, Multinational Corporations, and Community Conflict in Post-Colonial Nigeria, which is a book that I certainly look forward to seeing. To my far left, we have Lori Leonard, who is an associate professor in the Department of Health, Behavior, and Society at John Hopkins School of Public Health. She holds appointments in the Department of Anthropology and Sociology at Johns Hopkins, and is the director of the Center for Qualitative Studies in Health and Medicine. Her interests are in the anthropology of policy and medical anthropology. And since 2000, Dr. Leonard has been working on a long-term study of a new model for poverty reduction in Africa that took the form of a World Bank-sponsored oil pipeline in Chad. Her research has involved following 80 families, which is incredible, in the oil field region for more than a decade. And she's now also engaged in writing a book about the project. I have one small announcement for the audience, which is that we are videotaping. And so when it comes to the question and answer period, if you would prefer not to have your question videotaped, you're welcome to write it down on a piece of paper and pass it up to us. If you'd like to be on camera, I'm sure we can arrange that as well. Okay, so let's start with our first presenter. Like to begin?
Sure. Thanks much for the kind introduction. Thank you to Maria for the invitation and to the program, and to all of you for coming out. The one thing that was not mentioned was that it's a Friday, and I know that people have better things to do on Fridays, so I appreciate the audience. I also want to just say a note about the slides, which is that the slides don't go with the talk. They're just going to be circling in the background to give you something to look at. Perhaps if we could just put them on slide view, is that possible over there? To just, I think you just have to. And they will say the other comment about the slides. That's perfect, right there.
But are they going to
They will. Okay. They will. Is that some of these? It's actually prohibited to take pictures of the installations in Chad, and so some of these photos come out of ExxonMobil publications. Some of them come out of us taking photos in moving vehicles. Some of them are taken from quite a distance. So the quality of some of the slides might not be what you would like, but I think it will give you a sense of the oil fields region, what it looks like, what it feels like. So I think, as Beth mentioned, for the last 12 years, I've been doing ethnographic field work in the oil field region in Chad, following the implementation of the Chad-Cameroon pipeline project, mostly by following this cohort of families over time. While I am in public health, this ended up not having a lot to do with health, except in a very, very broad sense. So the pipeline project was a venture that was led by ExxonMobil, which was at the head of a consortium of oil companies that included Chevron and Petronas, which is the Malaysian state oil company. But what was interesting about it to me was that it was also sponsored by the World Bank. And the World Bank saw it as an opportunity to demonstrate that its doctrine of market liberalization combined with governance reforms could alleviate poverty. And more generally, that in the African case, extraction and the extractive industries could sort of drive this new wave of poverty reduction in Africa. In fact, the World Bank described the project in Chad as a template for how to do this and as a model for poverty reduction programming in the 21st century. So I'm interested in the project and in these model policies as forms of governance or as sort of ways of ordering life. And I'm interested in telling stories about about how these policies shape people's lives, how people experienced the project, how they lived alongside it, how it changed their sense of themselves and other people. At the same time that the project was a model, or was supposed to be an experiment, I should say, in poverty reduction, it was also the largest construction project on the African continent. And so I've become interested in thinking about these questions through material objects that actually circulate in the region. And so the working title of the book that I'm writing is Raw Materials, and I don't have a subtitle, the rest of the title yet. But it's about people's encounters with different types of things and the ideas that are bound up with them. And that ranges from waste materials that the consortium recycled into communities, to pornography and drugs like Viagra that were brought into the region by, initially at least, by workers on the oil rigs, to features of the landscape, like certain kinds of agricultural fields whose meanings were very radically transformed by, or in the context of these windfall compensation payments that were made to people by the consortium when their land was expropriated. And I see these tangible things as vehicles for tracing transformations in the region and in people's lives and in people's sense of themselves. So the things that I wanted to talk about today are letters, and specifically the grievance letters that people wrote to the consortium. So I thought I would do a very condensed, very sort of synoptic presentation of one of the chapters that's going to be called Dead Letters. So one of the things that caught my attention early on was that people wrote a lot of letters to the consortium. And there were two things that were sort of curious about this letter writing. The first thing was that most of the people who wrote letters couldn't read them or write them. They actually had to enlist other people to write letters for them. The second thing was that they kept writing even though they never got a response back from the consortium. And in fact, they complained about this, and they referred to their letters as dead letters, but even as they continued to produce them. So why did they write? And the most direct answer to that is that people wrote in response to a grievance mechanism that the consortium had set up on the advice of the World Bank. And as a general practice, the World Bank encourages private companies to set up grievance mechanisms in places where the state is thought of as absent, or where its authority is thought to be so weak or so thin or so attenuated that it isn't possible for people to obtain justice through the legal system. And extractive enclaves are often described in just that kind of way, as places that are sort of vacated by the state, even though that ignores other forms of regulation that structure life in those places, and sometimes just as powerfully as national governments or nation states, as Lade and Michael Watts and some others have shown. So I'm interested in the grievance mechanism as a mode of administration in the oil field region, and how it worked and the effects it had and people's interactions with it, and in what people made of it and of the technologies that it introduced, and particularly letters. So my claims are that, and I'll elaborate these in a second, but my claims are that the grievance mechanism domesticated disputes. And it transformed residents of the oil field region into individual claimants and into landowners, even in the absence of a land titling scheme or program. And in some cases, it transformed people into middle figures and into bureaucrats. And the grievance mechanism also provided people with the technology of letters that they used to record their claims and to project them into the future. So even if the consortium never answered their letters weren't dead. In fact, they were highly productive, and they effectively wrote the project into life. So disputes were domesticated by the grievance mechanism in two senses. They were tamed, and they were sequestered in villages and in domestic spaces, in families and in houses, where they had to be managed. The disputes were tamed because the grievance mechanism required people to frame their complaints really narrowly. And it's difficult to show this ethnographically in a short period of time, but I'm going to outline it for you, even though I can't really provide all the ethnographic material. So throughout the project, residents of the oil field region had very little contact actually with the consortium, except for a class of employees that were called local community contacts, or LCCs, and I'm going to come back to them in a minute. So people's communications with the consortium were really heavily mediated by intermediaries. People were taught how to write grievance letters by NGO activists. And they became sort of self-described monitors of the project. And they took up this monitoring role after the World Bank ignored their request to postpone the project. They had requested that the World Bank postpone it so that they could work with people on the ground. They could develop banking facilities. They could work with local businesses to make them more competitive for contracts, that kind of thing. As monitors, the NGOs tried to keep the consortium's feet to the fire. And one of the things they did was to disseminate the consortium's policies and encourage people to complain and to file grievances if those policies weren't followed. So they disseminated the compensation rates. They schooled people about the categories that the consortium used to evaluate their crops and their trees. They taught them the consortium's definitions for things like fields and bush and for productive versus non-productive trees. And so people took these things up in their letters. And what you see in the letters are people basically repeating the consortium's policies and asking the consortium to please abide by them. Once people had written their letters, the consortium said that the letter had to be co-signed by the chief of their village. Now, village chiefs, at least in Chad, are not agents of the state. They don't represent the state. They don't act on behalf of the state. But they were asked by the consortium to perform a range of state-like functions. And that included stamping and signing people's letters, but it also included things like drawing boundaries between counties, between villages, between people's fields. And serving as witnesses when people signed contracts or when people received compensation payments. So village chiefs had to be really careful about what letters they would sign, because as the pipeline project was getting underway, so were these governance reforms that included efforts to decentralize decision-making, which was supposed to bring decision-making closer to local governments and to give people in the oil field region a say in how oil revenues that were earmarked for the region would be spent. So there were multiple rounds of administrative restructuring that cut the country up into smaller and smaller governing units. And the effect of decentralization, the main one, in the oil field region was the proliferation of government posts and bureaucrats. And so paradoxically, instead of sort of devolving authority, it consolidated it, and it centralized it in Jemena and extended the reach of the central government and its emphasis on sort of clearing the way for oil production. So you had this situation in the oil field region where the sous-préfet and his subordinate, who is the chief of the county, were responsible for governing exactly the same territory in exactly the same population. So village chiefs had to move really carefully in this very densely sort of administered terrain. They had to be very careful what letters they would sign, because either the letter writer or the consortium or both could always appeal to a higher level authority who was almost literally right around the corner. So this made them very unwilling to sign controversial claims or claims that were outside the bounds of the policies that the consortium had already agreed to uphold. So finally, once the letter was co-signed, the letter writer had to bring it to the consortium employee, who I mentioned earlier, who was the local community contacts, or the LCCs. And these were young men from the oil field region who worked out of satellite offices in villages. And their job was to be liaisons between the oil companies and residents. And they were supposed to receive people's claims and judge them as founded or unfounded based on the consortium's policies, which were laid out in a document called the Compensation and Resettlement Plan. And initially, everyone, including the LCCs, had a hard time making sense of this document, and they found the policies to be really confusing. But as complaints came in, both farmers and LCCs learned, what the consortium's policies were and how to work with them. Initially, the LCCs investigated people's grievances with a certain degree of enthusiasm, but their interest in doing that waned as they came to know the policies and they began to describe them as nos principes, our principles. And I think this moment when they adopted the plural possessive pronoun was a really important one, and it sort of marked a turning point when they developed an understanding both of the policies but also of themselves vis-a-vis other residents. And I think they became what Nancy Hunt calls middle figures. And what she says, one of the things she says about middle figures is that they work to differentiate themselves from their lows. And the LCCs did this by describing farmers as people who were unable to master that plan. Because they were unsophisticated peasant farmers. They talked about them as people who squandered compensation money on alcohol and on women, as people who counted on the government and the project for assistance, and particularly as people who used tricks instead of industry to win compensation. So they became very suspicious of people and of their claims, and they began to basically to stuff their claims. It was also the case that at just about the same time that of the transformation of LCCs into middle figures, there was a dramatic uptick in letter writing as people learned how the consortium's policies worked and as they began to scramble to try to find ways to benefit from the project. So all of these intermediaries that in different ways were supposed to represent residents of the oil field region became they actually became co-managers of the project alongside the consortium and the World Bank. They coached people to write letters that would be legible to the consortium. They triaged people's claims according to their fit with the consortium's policies. And they received and they selectively processed their letters on behalf of the consortium. So disputes were tamed because in order to register a dispute, to register a grievance, it had to be framed in a particular way. These grievances had to align exactly with the consortium's policies. What the grievance process also did is to sequester disputes in villages and in domestic spaces far away from the extractive activities of the consortium. Village chiefs are obviously in villages. The LCCs were also located in satellite offices. They were not in the consortium's main base camps or their main sites of operation. And so the complaint circuit was really limited to these domestic spaces, to villages and to families, and it was completely separated from the realms or the spaces in which extractive activities were carried out. So there were incessant disputes and struggles over land and over compensation payments, but these never got in the way of the consortium's activities. They never interrupted the flow of oil. Okay, so we're still left with the question of why people continued to write, even when they knew that there would be no response from the consortium forthcoming. And I think that in thinking about that, it's important not to dissociate the form and the content of the letters from the ways that the letters circulated and how they were handled, how they were shared, how they were stored. So it was important to follow the letters and to think of them not just as texts that said something, but actually as documents, as tangible material objects. So people tried to distribute their letters really widely. They copied their letters to multiple people, including NGOs and human rights organizations, but also to other people in the village, including the village chief. And most importantly, they kept multiple copies of the letters. They made multiple copies of letters for themselves. And that was partly to improve their chances of getting a response because, you know, when people would come around, they would show them the letters. They would, anyone who they thought might be able to forward their claims or, you know, do some work on their behalf with the consortium, they would give a copy of the letter to. But I think it was also an attempt to sort of enter their letters into archives. So if you go to NGO offices in regional capitals, you would see folders full of these sort of complaint letters, these grievance letters. But the place where I saw most of the letters was actually in people's houses, and they were stored under people's mattresses, in suitcases, in plastic bags, always alongside other important documents like birth certificates, like national identity cards, like carnet de santé, you know, all the important documents in one place, and there was the claim letter. What was also interesting was that just as people worked to get their letters out there, to circulate them, to make them public, the consortium was doing the opposite. They were trying to expunge grievances completely from the record, from the official records at least, of the project, and to make it look like project implementation was going along very smoothly. So I spent years trying to get information about the letters that people submitted to the consortium. And they never refused to give them to me, but they never produced them either. So there was always, you know, one more permission I needed to acquire, one more person I needed to see, one more hoop I needed to jump through. But after a decade, I'm still waiting for this. And the only publicly available data on grievances that people filed with the consortium is in the consortium's first two quarterly reports, which were produced in late 2000 and early 2001. And this is before anybody in the oil field region really figured out what the consortium's policies were and before they really began writing letters. This was the moment when the NGOs were training people and teaching people how to write letters. So even though these quarterly reports are actually mandated as part of the consortium's agreement with the World Bank, and they're supposed to be an attempt at transparency and public accounting, after those first two reports, the section on grievances just disappeared, and it was never reinstated. So the grievance mechanism was actually a very powerful mode of administration that produced a number of the state effects that Rolf Trio described. And in concluding, I want to just sort of summarize those. These different kinds of intermediaries that I described, they brought people's claims into alignment with the normative frame of the compensation and resettlement plan. And the grievance mechanism interpolated these intermediaries as, you know, into the project as co-managers, and they assumed roles that were vital to the project's implementation. They did it wittingly or unwittingly. In some cases, it was unwittingly. And I think that the practices they engaged in transformed them into middle figures and bureaucrats. And so the grievance mechanism created subject populations that saw themselves as different from most farmers, as more modern, as more sophisticated, as belonging to privileged groups or privileged classes. And so this is an example of what Trio calls identification effects, right? These intermediaries also ensured that people's grievances were framed narrowly and in direct response to the provisions of the plan. So the letters had to identify, letter writers had themselves to identify as individuals who could claim exclusive rights to land, to trees, to crops, to animals, to houses, to structures, to whatever it is they were making a claim to. And the grievance mechanism forced letter writers to identify as private landowners, even in the absence of a land titling system. And this is what Trio calls isolation effects. The grievance mechanism also contained disputes in communities and families far away from the extractive activities, where disputes wouldn't interrupt the flow of oil, and it created and it reified boundaries, including the boundaries between counties, the boundaries between villages, even the boundaries between people's fields. This is what Trio calls spatialization effects. And finally, it provided residents of the oil field region with a language, including terms, categories, and arguments for making claims that could be recognized by the consortium. And this is what he calls legibility effects. What Rolf Trio didn't write about about state effects as taking tangible and material or material form, but documents, I think, are an important type of state effect, because obviously states produce documents and letters are material traces of the state. So the letters that people kept in their houses alongside other important documents actually functioned as a dispersed land registry. They functioned as handwritten certificates of title that codified people's claims to land, even in the absence of courts of law or cadastral offices or any attempt to register land, which didn't happen as part of this project. Those letters have no legal standing. They wouldn't be recognized in a court of law or in a cadastral office, and they wouldn't even make sense to people outside the oil field region if they read them. But they serve as official records of land claims. They even look official with the stamps and the signatures of the village chief on them. And they established individual farmers as having exclusive rights to property, which was really important in an environment where there was already significant land pressure before the project began, and that pressure was very much exacerbated by the land loss associated with the project. So the letters were documents that wrote the project into life, both by naturalizing the language and the logics that the consortium introduced and making them part of everyday life, but also by their material presence. And I think people kept writing them because the letters kept their claims very much alive.
Thank you. Mm.